From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
This is the Bryant Park Project, your home for news and movie reviews and pregnancy advice. Mostly from me.
Are you doing that, Luke?
I'm covering a lot of the pregnancy stuff. I'm Luke Burbank,
by
the way.
You're in the bun in the oven beat?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I'm Allison Stewart. Hey, nothing is better on a hot, hot August day than going to the movie theater, putting your butt down, getting a bucket of popcorn bigger than your head, and it also helps when the movie's good, too. So that's why NPR's Bob Mondello is going to join us to tell us about the hottest stage, Resurrecting the Champ, maybe Mr. Bean, maybe the Nana Diaries.
He's also got some picks for most underrated movies of the summer, which will be good. Because a lot of the ones that are out right now, I've been hearing mixed reviews on, the famous ones anyway.
Super bad, super good.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
And that's going to be this weekend. A Quart of Gin and Super Bad. That's my weekend. The Little League World Series is going on. If you have flashed past any of the 9 ESPN channels, you have seen young boys crying as they strike out or get home runs or do whatever they do. We're going to talk to somebody about some of the hallmarks of Little League culture, including mustache kid and kid in jeans.
Looking forward to it. Also, we're going to talk about Senator John Warner's comments about taking troops out of Iraq. Of course, we do this every Friday. It's called The Week in Iraq. You want to stick around for that.
We're also going to do The Ramble, The Most, plus Matt Martinez has all the news headlines. First, though, we've got today's top story.
Job website Monster.com said yesterday that someone stole the personal information of 1.3 million users.
The thieves apparently posed as corporate customers to get into Monster's database, which has like 70 million people's resumes. And then they took the names, addresses, and phone numbers and email addresses of these people. Then they contacted those people whose information they had stole, pretending to be employers, and tried to get those people to give them their social security numbers and their bank info.
Now, the FBI and the Secret Service are investigating the case. They've been able to trace some of the activity to a home computer in Ukraine. Now, in our production meeting this morning, everybody had some story of someone they knew that was affected by data theft in one form or another. We all know how it happens. People get our information online after you just put it in pretty regularly now. It's sort of surprising. Sometimes I surprise myself, Luke, when I'm just typing in Allison Stewart and I live at la 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 la. My phone number is X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, I do this seriously 3 times a day. I join some stupid eBay thing or some whatever, and you got to put your stuff in. And I always think, like, is this going to be the one that gets someone to steal all of my information? Although, as I said in the meeting, I'm the only person who could have their ID stolen and it was actually improve their credit score. So maybe it's not such a bad thing for me. But for other people, you don't want this to happen.
Yeah. So we know what happens. People get the information online. But then what happens next? Where does it go on the black market? How does it operate? How much is it worth? So we wanted to check in with Greg Kaiser from Computer World. He wrote a great Q&A all about the Monster.com issue. Hey, Greg. So hypothetically, somebody gets hold of this personal information of these users of Monster.com, 1.3 million, they're where they live, where they went to college, blah, blah, blah. What can they do with that?
Did you hear in the background Greg typing?
I did hear him typing, which made me think it was very realistic that he worked at Computer World.
Greg, what were you typing that was so important you couldn't be on our radio show? Hi, Greg. You're on the Bryant Park Project. Can you hear us? I don't think Gregory can hear us in there, guys.
The typing was cracking me up.
You know he's serious about his job, though, right?
Which means he's probably got a Bluetooth on our headset, right? Because I heard there was a lot.
Can you email him? He'll probably get the email faster than actually hearing us talking to him.
Apparently, yeah, I sure can.
They can hear him in the control room.
All right. This is going to be one of the more – hi, Greg. Can you hear us?
All I can hear is you. And it just goes, whenever you're not talking, I'm hearing just dead silence.
Whenever we're not talking, he's hearing just dead silence.
I guess it's just going to be a one-way interview with Greg Kaiser.
Should we just keep it moving there, Dan?
What do you think?
No, I'm here.
Greg, it's Allison at the Bryant Park Project.
Hey,
do you hear me now?
How are you doing this morning?
Excellent. Technology. Never let a machine know you're on a timetable.
Dun, 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 dun.
You know what I'm saying? thanks for being with us and hanging in there, Greg.
Yeah,
my question to you is that, hypothetically, you got this information from this 1.3 million Monster.com customers. You're the guy who stole it. What's the first thing you do with that information? Just where somebody lives, where somebody went to college, what their GPA is?
Well, it seems what what these people did is use it to create a spam campaign, in other words, junk email campaign, that went out trying to entice people to do a couple of different things. In one case, to download a free tool that was being sort of hyped as an assistant to people who were using Monster.com.
So you get this email and it says, click here.
Pretty much, exactly. I mean, we've all seen those kinds of email messages, and most of us know it, you know, better than to actually follow through. But when the email comes in with your name on it, comes in with you know, labeling that looks like Monster.com, may even have other kinds of information that was on your resume, you know, maybe your street address, for instance, you're more likely to take it at face value and think, well, you know, this is probably legit, so I'm going to go ahead and click.
I was wondering, I get a lot of spam that is pretending to be people from eBay, and I actually buy a lot of stuff on eBay, and I'm wondering, is it tailored to me? Like, you know, when you go online and you sort of interact with a certain website a lot, is there some way people can find that out and know? Because it seems like a lot of the spam I get is actually pretty on point with, in terms of what I do.
You know, in that case, from what you're describing, probably not. It, you know, there's a good reason why they do spam that's labeled with eBay, because eBay is used by a large number of people.
Okay.
So their chance of hitting someone like you, you know, is pretty good. You know, this is a lot different, this Monster.com incident, because, you know, it's very targeted. They're not just sort of dragging a net, but, in fact, the term for this kind of targeted phishing mail is called spear phishing.
Because it's so direct.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's targeted right at an individual, you know, a specific individual, and oftentimes in you know, very detailed, very convincing and believable kind of messaging.
One more question for
sure.
You. Is this sloppiness on Monster.com's part at all, or is this just par for the course if you put your information up on a website like this?
That's a good question, and I think I'd hesitate to answer because I don't think that we have quite enough information. It's definitely clear, though, that the people who started this, that you know, basically went in and searched through and dug out this 1.3 million names or resume information from Monster were using legitimate credentials that probably had been stolen. So, you know, Monster's response to that is, well, you know, it's a little difficult for us to safeguard everybody's username and password when, you know, the criminals might have gotten that through any sort of means, you know, maybe over the phone, maybe, you know, through other kind of phishing campaigns. So, you know, at this point, I think a lot of users who I've talked to or read comments on my stories would definitely agree with you that it is sloppy. But, you know, on my part, I think I'm holding judgment, at least until I get more information.
The good news is that at least the hackers know that a lot of these people are interested in working in a dynamic environment where they can help with a team.
Using their people skills.
Right.
Along
right.
the way.
So, you know, that was one of the really interesting things I thought, you know, when I first started covering this was, you know, some of the phishing mails and the offers, you know, were for jobs, and those jobs were, you know, illegitimate, illegal kind of jobs. But, you know, the people that were behind this know that the people that are posting resumes on Monster are maybe looking for a job. Maybe they haven't had a job in a long time. Maybe they'd be more willing to sort of cross to the dark side.
Yeah, eager to click.
Yeah.
Hey, Greg Kaiser from Computer World, great Q&A on computerworld.com. Thanks so much for walking us through all that.
Yeah, you bet. Have a good day.
You too now.
Bye-bye.
All right, here's Matt Martinez.
This is NPR.
Here is Matt Martinez with the news.
Thanks, guys. Hello, everyone. More thunderstorms, more heat, and more humidity in the Midwest. This is on top of the region's flooding misery. Thousands of people are returning to damaged homes today, many without electricity to run fans or pumps. Last night, a sudden thunderstorm with 70-mile-per-hour winds hit the Chicago area. Part of an industrial facility's roof collapsed, injuring 40 people, and a tornado was reported as a storm moved into Michigan. Republican Senator John Warner called for troop withdrawals from Iraq by Christmas. Warner is the former chairman of the Armed Services Committee and was Navy Secretary during the Vietnam War. Warner says the president should get to decide when and how many troops should leave, and that it should send a powerful message that the U.S. commitment in Iraq was not open-ended. Meanwhile, a summary of the National Intelligence Estimate says that the Iraqi government will become more precarious over the next 6 to 12 months, and its security forces cannot function without outside help. The 10-page document also concludes that Iraq's sectarian groups have yet to reconcile, and that al-Qaeda is in Iraq is still able to conduct deadly and highly visible attacks. More on that coming up on The Week in Iraq. Three-term Representative Rick Renzi said he will not seek re-election next year. The Arizona Republican is the fifth GOP House member in recent weeks to announce he is retiring. Renzi is facing a federal inquiry into his family's insurance business. And former NASA astronaut Lisa Nowak went before a judge in Florida today. It's a preliminary hearing before her trial begins next month on charges of attempted battery against what prosecutors say was a perceived romantic rival. She asked a judge to let her remove her electronic monitoring ankle bracelet, saying that it causes abrasions and that she can't lace up her military boots with it on. She's accused of attacking a romantic rival with pepper spray and trying to jump into her vehicle. Police say Nowak had a duffel bag with a steel mallet, 4-inch knife, and a BB gun. I'm Matt Martinez. The news is always online at npr.org.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Luke Burbank, Allison Stewart standing by. In our ongoing attempt to kind of pick up all the pieces of news that kind of come out of Iraq every week, we try to fit those together for you. We've got a trademark segment, which we like to call The Week in Iraq. Things got off to a bad start on Monday when the governor of Muthanna province in southern Iraq was killed by a roadside bomb. Muhammad Ali al-Hassani was traveling just a few miles from his home to the provincial capital when he was killed. He was the second provincial governor to be assassinated in 10 days.
Well, first of all, our condolences, of course, go out to the families of these brave soldiers. I can't say much about it because it is under investigation, but there is no indication at this time that it was a result of hostile fire.
That's Major General Benjamin Mixon talking about a crash on Wednesday in northern Iraq. A Black Hawk helicopter went down, killing 14 U.S. troops aboard. As you heard, the military thinks it was mechanical problems, not hostile fire brought the chopper down. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, Iraqis suffered through their fifth summer in a row with only a couple of hours of electricity each day. Electricity Minister Waheed Karim told the LA Times it probably will be 3 or 4 years before power needs can be met. The weather forecast this weekend in Baghdad, tomorrow sunny and 114. More of the same on Sunday. Things will cool off, though, next Thursday when it will be 108 degrees.
The fundamental question is, will the government respond to the demands of the people? And if the government doesn't respond to the demands of the people, they will replace the government. That's up to the Iraqis to make that decision, not American politicians.
Here in the U.S., President Bush spent the week kind of defending Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. This week, Democrats, some of them running for president, some of them in Congress, were calling for Maliki to be removed. Here's Senator Carl Levin.
I hope that the Iraqi Assembly, when it reconvenes in a few weeks, will vote the Maliki government out of office, will have the wisdom to replace it with a less sectarian, more unifying prime minister and government.
Maliki's government does not come out looking so great, according to the National Intelligence Estimate that was released yesterday. This is basically where all the U.S. spy agencies, something like 15 of them, they get together, they give their joint assessment of what's going on in Iraq. The basics of the report are that violent attacks have actually gone down a bit, thanks to recent U.S. tactics. But they say that could be undone very easily if the troops pull out, and they say there is very little hope that the Iraqi government is going to become in any way effective in the next year. The White House tried to kind of accentuate the positive yesterday when this report, the NIE, came out, but then this happened.
I make a recommendation to the president to announce on the 15th that in consultation with our senior military commanders, he's decided to initiate the first step in a withdrawal of our forces.
That's Virginia Republican John Warner. He's former chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. He was just in Iraq last week. Now he says it's time to send a message by pulling out at least some troops.
He say to the president respectfully, certainly in 160,000 plus, say 5,000, could begin to redeploy and be home to their families and loved ones no later than Christmas.
This is sort of bad news for the White House because John Warner is a very old, very respected Republican from a pretty Republican state, Virginia, and if he's calling for even a limited pullout, that could really kind of signal that a tide could be changing. Other stuff, The Daily Show, which often pretends to be in Iraq, actually went to Iraq recently. This week they've been airing those reports. Here's Rob Riggle talking to soldiers.
But Indiana Congressman Mike Pence hit the nail on the head. If there's one thing that everyone I've talked to can agree on, it's that Iraq is exactly like an Indiana market in the summertime.
How is Indiana like Iraq?
Well, I'd have to say maybe the women. No, not the women. The food. No, not the food either. I have to say this place isn't like home at all.
It's just like home.
Kevin Blyer is a writer and producer for The Daily Show. He produced that segment. And the others the show's been playing this week, he is safely back here in New York now, and he joins us. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Happy to be back in sub-100-degree temperature, sir.
I bet you could identify with that, talking about the, you know, not having any power for air conditioning in Baghdad.
Oh, it's all generators over there on the bases, certainly. On the bases, there's a constant hum from the, I guess, the KBR generators that are always humming to make sure that everybody does have electricity and, quite frankly, a lot of great food. I was surprised by that as well.
So that things are maybe okay on the base, but out in the rest of Baghdad, it's
well, admittedly,
rough.
We stayed on the bases. We did. We were there primarily and fundamentally for a USO show. Rob Riggle had the idea about a year ago. I should mention, Rob Riggle is in fact a Marine. He's still in the Marine Reserves as a major.
Wow.
He was based in Liberia and Kosovo and Afghanistan. And so when he got the job on The Daily Show, he had the thought that perhaps he would. He made a promise to himself years ago that he would do his own USO tour if he ever had that opportunity. And so he proposed it to John. And in fact, John said yes. And so we went over there with the thought of entertaining the troops. And you'll have to ask them if we did a decent job of that.
Well, that's what I was wondering about, because so much of what happens on The Daily Show is a pretty satirical take on the war and some of the, you know, missteps. Were the soldiers cool to you guys?
Absolutely. They were. I mean, I suppose it might be a self-filtering group, but of the people that did approach us and say something about the show, there were some incredibly rabid fans. Rob even had the occasion on occasion to hear people cite lines back to him that he had said or John had said, or if I may be so bold, one or two that I had even written. So it was an odd thing to – so I would say it's a long way to go to have your ego stroked, but nonetheless, they were happy to see him and say we're big fans of the show and of you in particular.
Is it hard to come up with funny bits when you're afraid of getting blown up all the time?
I would argue that I don't want to. I deserve no badges for courage, but I suppose it is. Yes, it's somewhat difficult to do that. You know, there were. I wouldn't say we felt that we were in imminent danger, but there were a few moments. Whether you're traveling between bases, primarily, where you think if anything were to happen, this is when it would happen. And you know, certainly to hear the news this week that people did, in fact, you know, have a crash of a Black Hawk helicopter only days before we, in fact, had traveled by Black Hawk helicopter, it does feel all the more real, and it does feel like that we're lucky to be back.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah, please.
Is there anything that's off limits to you guys when you start writing jokes about Iraq that you just say, don't touch that, no, not funny?
Well, the truth, you know, the old algebra of tragedy plus time equals comedy doesn't always apply, and that's the truth here. Iraq is deathly serious, and we were there to entertain the troops and, quite frankly, bring them a joke or two. So that was our mantra. That's what was our guiding principle, and with any luck, that's exactly what we did. Are there things that are off limits? Yes, and we choose not to step there.
Okay, what's not off limits?
Well, I mean, you know, anything where the person in – well, that's a simple answer. You don't want to victimize the victimized. You don't want to attack anyone that doesn't deserve to be attacked, that isn't putting themselves out there. And quite frankly, we were happy to do what we did, which is support the troops and entertain them as much as possible.
Hold on. Turn the music down for a second. I don't care. We already busted the segment, so I want to ask you one more question.
Did you?
Yeah. Not that anyone even knows what that means. So The Daily Show increasingly has become a real source of news for people, even though you guys probably didn't set out to do that. When you're over in a place like Iraq, are you feeling like pressure to actually bring real information because you guys have become this source of news for so many people?
We don't, and I would argue that John, you know, I can't speak for John, but we don't have an obligation to report the news. We have an obligation to do what we do, which is to be a satirical show and deliver, hopefully, a unique take on what is the news, but not to report it. We aren't reporters. I wasn't a stringer in Beirut. I was a guy helping Rob Riegel on a USO tour with a handycam. And so the obligation there, unfortunately, is others to do, and it's up to them to decide if they're delivering on it.
Kevin Blyer, writer and producer for The Daily Show, just back from Iraq. Thank you so much.
Happy to be here.
Coming up on the Bryant Park Project, the news worth honorable mention. It's called The Ramble, and Nicole Richie, 82 minutes in jail. 82.
She was going to get 86, but she got 4 minutes off for good behavior. Hey-o. I got to stop using those good jokes in the meeting because then they sound so disingenuous to the staff when I try to break them out on the show. Also, we've got a discussion about pot meatballs and if that's a legitimate reason to test positive if you're an NYPD detective. Answer? No.
This is the Bryant Park. What is it called?
I think we're calling it the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Thanks. And this is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Luke Burbank. This is a song by Baby Boy to Prince, This Is the Way I Live, which I think has probably been out for months. Everyone cooler than me already knows about it. But yesterday, one of our producers, Lauren, turned me on to it, and I was like, can we please play that tomorrow? So there you go.
Your wish is their command.
I know. It's pretty awesome. Hey, coming up, we're going to get a movie review from NPR's own Bob Mondello. But first, as you dedicated listeners know here on the BPP, we have a lot of stories that don't quite rise to the level of actual coverage, but we feel a little remiss if we don't actually mention them at some point in the show. And for that, for those kinds of stories, we have a little segment we like to call The Ramble.
Somebody went to prison for 82 minutes. 82 minutes. Not really a hugely important person in the world. Nicole Richie, who is actually supposed to serve 4 whole days for driving the wrong way on the 134 freeway, which you said is pretty much...
It's a big old freeway. That's not a highway. That is not two lanes, man. That thing is big.
Apparently she's using the marijuana and the Vicodin. 82 minutes she showed up to go to jail. And that's just... ridiculous.
And what the people from the jail said was, look, it's overcrowded. This is how we treat everyone. If you have a, you know, nonviolent offense like this and it's your first one, this is what we're going to do. Message being, hey, blaze them if you got them. Apparently that gets you 82 minutes in jail in L.A.
Something else, man.
A 52-year-old UCLA professor is arguing that students and teachers should be able to have relations. He says that the right to romance is covered by the Ninth Amendment of the Constitution.
It's just, first of all, makes me think, so what has this guy been doing
right
for the past 30 years?
Well, everyone
he's given it this much thought.
Everyone knows that person or persons in high school who hooked up with that kind of youngish professor.
Yeah.
So it's like it's already happening. The question
he had the
is,
red wine in the basket bottle right in his office during office hours.
The blazer with the leather patches on the elbows, that yeah guy.
An NYPD detective lost his job this week because he failed a drug test. Now, the officer says he failed the test because his wife served him marijuana meatballs. His wife said she'd secretly substituted marijuana for oregano in her meatball recipe in hopes of forcing him to leave police work.
You know, I gotta say, though, at first blush, I was like, this is a ridiculous story. Then I read the actual story, mm-hmm, and she apparently she passed a lie detector test. I mean, that's what she and her husband say. He'd been in the force for 25 years.
Counterterrorism?
Like, he didn't seem to be the profile, whatever that is, of somebody who is blazing it up. It's one of those things that's so ridiculous. Something about it rung slightly true to me, but not to Ray Kelly, commissioner of the NYPD.
And that does it for this edition of The Ramble. You know, on a hot August day, nothing better than putting your derriere in a movie theater seat to enjoy the air conditioning. It's always nice if the movie is good, too. NPR arts critic Bob Mondella is going to guide us through that part of the program. So, Bob, Resurrecting the Champ is this new movie starring Josh Hartnett and Samuel L. Jackson. The tagline for the movie is, based on a true story that was based on a lie. What does that mean?
Oh, it's based very, very loosely on a true story. There was a reporter in Los Angeles who went and interviewed a guy who said he was a prize fighter on the streets. He was a homeless guy. And the story turned out to be partly true. They've moved it to Denver. They've made it all about the reporter. Samuel Jackson's giving an amazing performance as the homeless guy. I mean, he's just fantastic. He's talking in this really high falsetto-like raspy voice like he's been drinking forever. And it's just, he's terrific. And then Josh Hartnett is in the picture, and he's kind of a lump. I mean, seriously, the guy's beautiful. He's very pleasant on the eyes, easy on the eyes, but he's not a great actor.
Well, let's listen to the lump and the actor in this clip.
I never dreamed, though, I'd be heavyweight champ. I always thought that I would win it.
You fought LaMotta. You fought Patterson. This article is my title shot.
All right, son. You ask your questions, I answer.
There's a little Mike Tyson in there.
Yes, there is.
That's ludicrous.
I guess maybe he got hit in the throat.
Would you recommend this movie?
It's not terrible. I mean, I found it kind of moving. It's all about fathers and sons. They've each got a father and a son that they've had problems with. There's something there, but it's not a great picture. It wants to be a knockout, and it just ain't.
Let's move on to The Hottest State, which is based on a novel by Ethan Hawke. Sort of a love story. Now, is Hawke involved in the movie at all?
Well, Hawke, yes. Let me think.
He
adapted his novel for the screenplay. He directed the picture. He appears as the father of a character who's very much like him. So that he's all over this picture. And it sounds like a vanity project, right? I mean, it ought to be just terrible. And this kid, Mark Weber, who plays the lead, is really terrific. And it's about young love. I mean, they fall in love. And for the first hour, it's bliss. And you believe it. It's like, it really is effective.
Let's listen to a little bit of a love scene between the two leads from the high.
Listen, if you could be inside my body when I see you or touch you, or think that I might see you or touch you, you would stop crying and slap me because I'm either crazy about you or I'm going crazy.
You are crazy?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah?
Well, if you don't say, I'm gonna get over my stupid hang-ups and fall desperately in love, I'm gonna jump off this bed.
I'm not gonna say that.
Say it!
I don't have any stupid hang-ups.
Oh, you better say it!
You know what? Let's talk.
Is this a chick flick?
Oh yeah. Oh totally. So much. But it's also it's a really nice picture. It sounded to me like it was going to be a vanity project, and it kind of isn't. He's he's a smart man, Ethan Hawke, and he's made a very interesting little picture.
I think he wanted to mess with people with the name of the book, though. The Hot Estate, because you're constantly going, no, not the Hot Estate. the Ruger.
Right. It actually refers to two things. The Hot Estate is Passion and also Texas, which is where he's from. Mm.
He's also smart enough to cast Laura Linney in his movie, who's such a fantastic actress, which makes me wonder how she ended up in The Nanny Diaries exactly. What was the anticipation for this film?
Well, you couldn't not be kind of excited about it because it's the second picture by the folks who did American Splendor, which was really wonderful and dealt with real life in the same – it dealt with diaries and things like that in the same way. And it had Scarlett Johansson in it. And Laura Linney, I mean, you do kind of have to think that it's going to be something. I was out of the country when it started showing to critics, and everyone I talked to said, "Oh, steer clear of this one." So I didn't even go. I mean, I've only been back a few days. I didn't even bother going to it.
Well, for people who aren't familiar with it, it was a book that was hugely successful, chronicling a nanny's life with an Upper East Side, extremely wealthy family. Here's a little bit of Laura Linney as the mother of the household and her expectations for her little darling child.
Nanny, in the morning, I need you to stop at Tiffany's and pick up Mr. X's watch. Then I need you to Xerox some recommendation letters for Grayer's collegiate application. Also, we should introduce French food into his diet. It might enhance his study of the language. Dry cleaning.
She's just the nightmare of a mom. So we'll let people decide what they think. You can always go to our website, npr.org/Bryant Park, and tell us what you think about The Nanny Diaries if you go see it. But, Bob, before we let you go, we want to know one movie we should go see that's just not getting the juice and the hype that all these other films have been getting.
That's not getting it? I think Rocket Science is wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's about a little kid who is he's a stutterer and he joins the debate team to impress a girl. And you totally think you know where that's going, but it so doesn't go there because it's by the guy who made Spelling Bee, that picture about... Mm-hmm. He's a very strange indie outsider to Hollywood, and he doesn't take it where you think it's going to go.
Shh, no more. No more.
Okay.
For people who want to go see Rocket Science. Bob Mondello, NPR movie critic. Thanks a lot, Bob.
It's always a pleasure.
This is NPR.
I remembered not to talk over that thing this time. I'm very proud. Time for some news headlines that we're following. Let's see. Republican Senator John Warner said there should be troop withdrawals from Iraq by Christmas. Warner chaired the Armed Services Committee, and he was Navy Secretary during the Vietnam War. He says bringing home some troops would send a powerful message that the U.S. commitment in Iraq was not open-ended.
And the new intelligence estimate suggests things will get worse in Iraq before they get better. The 10-page document also concludes that Iraq's sectarian groups have yet to reconcile, and al-Qaeda in Iraq is still able to conduct deadly and highly visible attacks. The NIA represents the consensus view of America's 16 intelligence agencies.
Still no relief for the Midwest, where new storms pounded Illinois, Iowa, and Minnesota late last night. 70-mile-an-hour winds whipped Chicago, leaving hundreds of thousands of people without power, canceling lots of flights. It's been almost a week of heavy rain and floods across the upper Midwest. Hundreds of homes have been damaged, and the storms have been blamed for at least 16 deaths.
You can find the news online all the time at npr.org.
And that's ripped into center field at the warning track, and it's caught! What a catch! What a catch! And Massachusetts wins!
Now, none of the players in that highlight clip have armpit hair, Allison.
You know that for a fact?
Okay, I'm speculating, but they're not major league players. They're actually kids. They're like 12-year-old, 13-year-old kids who are in the Little League World Series. Every summer about this time, the world's best Little League teams descend on Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Peter Schrager is a columnist with FoxSports.com. He wrote a really great article about some of the hallmarks of Little League baseball, and he joins us now. Hi, Peter.
How you guys doing?
Good, good. The Little League World Series, it seems like it's getting to be a bigger deal every year. It used to be they just put the championship game on ABC on one Saturday. Now every single game is on TV. Why do you think it's turning into such a big deal?
Yeah, it's become enormous. I mean, back in the day when we used to grow up, it was always just the finals. You'd watch, you'd get sucked into it. Now you can find it on ESPN2, ESPN, ABC. It's all over the place. It's really taken on a life of its own. I think it's, you know, everyone's interest. This is purity of sports. I mean, there's some ugly things going on in sports these days. You can turn to these kids, though, and there's nothing unpure about what they've got going on.
Is it good sports or is it good TV?
Yeah, you know, it's a little bit of just good competition. It's international. There's still always that element to it. And there's the whole idea of just celebrity and these kids and living the life. I mean, I remember growing up, there was always these World Series teams, these stars. I mean, Chris Drury is a player right now on the New York Rangers. He's making several million dollars. He's won Stanley Cup trophies as a hockey player. You mention Chris Drury's name to someone, they will still say, oh, 1989, Trumbull, Connecticut, Little League World Series. I mean, these guys become
stars. I remember
stars,
that team.
And everyone remembers them for that. And even I remember I was back in Jersey, I guess in the late 90s, I was home. And I remember hearing on the radio there was a Green Day song. It was Good Riddance, and they had highlights of the Toms River Championship spliced within. So for a kid to have, you know, Billy Joe Armstrong singing about him, even if it's chemically or produced like that, that's fine. But it is celebrity, and it's very cool to see kids live out their dreams.
I think, too, for me, when I see one of these games, I can't turn it off. And it's not because I care, like, is Curaçao going to beat the team from Dallas? It's because, you know, whatever happens at the end, it's going to be the biggest deal that has ever happened in the lives of these little kids. And to see, you know, one team victorious and just, like, so happy about that and one team so sad, you know, it's weirdly engaging, even though I don't care anything about the teams and I don't know anything about who's good and who's bad, but it's really engaging stuff.
You're right. I mean, I'm on this Lubbock, Texas bandwagon, but I couldn't tell you one thing.
There's a Lubbock, Texas bandwagon.
But, he's on it by himself, out in the field.
No, but every person, I mean, especially young boys and girls, everyone can at least kind of empathize or sympathize with these kids. And we all played Little League growing up, and, you know, whether you were the kid who was wearing jeans and sneakers or you were the kid batting third and making the All-Star team, everyone's been through those moments. And it's you know, and as an NFL player, I look at what they're doing, those Warriors, those Gladiators, and I can't really relate. But you put a Little League player out there, and I know where he was when he struck out in the bottom of the sixth inning to lose the game or when he made that game-winning catch. So I think there's kind of that feeling of it, too. Like, oh, Little League, I did that. That was fun, you know?
But, Peter, I want to go back to something you said in your first answer about there's so much bad stuff going on in sports right now and that Little League is so clean. But wasn't there like a 42-year-old guy, that Danny kid
Danny
that was
Almonte.
Playing? Danny Almonte.
Yeah.
I mean, is there a dark side to the
Little
League?
Yeah, there is. I mean, that was 2001. Danny Almonte was, you know, dominating. It was really a big New York story because, you know, that team was from New York and they stormed right through, and then it found out that he was much older than 13 years old. And I think in 1992, I believe, the Taiwan, the team from Taiwan, same kind of deal, and they ended up having to give up their championship. So there is some ugly stuff. But when you look at what's going on, whether it's dogs fighting or it's Las Vegas strip club shootouts or even NBA refs, you know, cheating and gambling, this is Little League. These kids don't have those agendas. There might be some things with the age here and there, but at its core, it's Little League baseball. We've all been there. And at the end of the game, they're going to shake hands and talk about Big League Chew.
Well, on the subject of us all being there, you wrote this great column for foxsports.com or .net?
.com.
And you laid out some of – right when I read it, I started cracking up because Seattle, Washington, this was totally my experience, and you had it somewhere in the East wherever you grew up. We're not here to talk about your life, Peter, so just relax.
I'm going
to
calm down.
Me about Mustache Kid and Jeans Kid.
Yeah, I mean, every Little League team had their own fixtures. There was the coach's son. All right, he was on every team and treated like gold, no matter if he can throw a baseball or not or hit a pitch. He was the gold. He was going to be on the All-Star team, so you already allotted that spot for him. Mustache Kid was – no one knew how old he was. Mustache usually went along with some acne, maybe some armpit hair. That was a big deal back then. He was always on the team, and he could always strike you out, and he could always hit a home run. And
sometimes with his stash.
Yeah, I mean, just a stash. Sometimes there was nothing else, just a stash. And then there was Jeans Kid. He always lost his pants the first week of the season. His mother never got a chance to replace it. And he showed up wearing jeans and usually sneakers to go along with that.
Always played right field.
Really didn't get that much playing time. But when he did, you noticed him out there. He had those blue denim jeans on, and that wasn't part of the uniform.
The tough skins.
Oh, man. Peter Schrager from FoxSports.com taking us back. Thank you very much for talking Little League.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much. It's a pleasure.
Well, a big part of the Bryant Park Project has obviously been our blog, because if you're listening to this, you might be listening through the website, or you might be listening on iTunes. And we're always encouraging people to write in, and people have been pretty active, responding to past things on our shows. For example, we had this conversation about whether or not Merv Griffin was gay, because there really wasn't a whole lot of mention of his sexuality in his obituaries, brief allusion in the New York Times, but the website of the Hollywood Reporter, columnist Ray Richland went online mentioning that Merv was gay. Then the column was pulled, later put back up. So we wanted to know all the secrecy around Merv's life, and was it a sign of progress or proof that nothing has changed at all? Well, Ray Richmond wrote into us on our blog. He said, "It was puzzling to me. And things truly appear not to have changed, but both my column on and blog post, after having been briefly pulled, were restored within an hour on Friday, 8/17, and a victory for freedom of speech in the unlikely venue of a Hollywood industry trade. Thanks for shining a light on where others won't."
All right. Well, here are some people on the blogs, on our blog, and their reaction. This is a person who likes us, Mara, who I love. She wrote a couple nice things. One of the things she wrote was, "Loved the new music segment. More please, as often as possible. It was nice to listen to Dan's mother-in-law," that would be Dan Pashman, our director, "talk about the Prague Spring and the invasion after seeing the pictures Dan linked a few days earlier. Great show. As usual, you guys are rocking like 41 pieces of flair." But then there was Megan Hall.
Yeah, Megan's she's not digging our show.
Yeah, she thought we only had 28 pieces of flair.
She says, "I'm not even sure we got to 15 as far as Megan's concerned." She says, "I know the show is trying to appeal to young listeners." That's kind of true. "So I gave it a try, but I could barely listen for longer than a minute. The part I heard sounded more like commercial radio than any sort of experimental sound based on conversation. If you want inspiration for a real conversational style, talk to Robert Krulwich or Jab Amrod at Radiolab. I'm constantly impressed by their style." Well, as are we, Megan, so thanks for writing in. One thing we should make sure people know, this is a work in progress. We are still developing the show, developing our voice, developing our sound, and we'll be a real live radio show one day. But we continue to like constructive criticism, and maybe you'll like our show, and maybe you won't.
And, yeah. And can I just chime in here?
Oh, yes, Matt Martinez.
Yes, Matt Martinez.
Wow, that
yeah,
was scary.
I just stay in the corner and lurk.
Nobody puts Matt in a corner.
No, yeah, actually, they do often. Yeah. It's awful. Robert Krulwich and Jad Abumrad, they produce that within an inch of its life.
This is, by the way, we should just say this show that she was referring to is called Radio Lab. It's produced by WNYC.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant.
An
it's
amazing
fantastic
program. But yeah, it is like the most highly produced. I mean, that's why it's so awesome, because Jad, I think in particular, sits and cuts every breath, every single little bit of sound is very carefully placed, and it works. It's an amazing program. But you know, we're not trying to do exactly that show, and I think that, you know, I think it's going to take a little time for people to get used to. I think there's a couple things going on. First of all, most of the time, think about when you hear a song. You almost never love a song instantaneously. You hear it, you kind of think it's okay, then you hear it again. The fourth or fifth time you hear it, you're like, "Oh, I love that, you know, whatever, yeah. Travis Tritt." I think our show is a little bit like a song. I think you have to listen to it a few times, let it grow on you.
And if she's afraid of us becoming too commercial radio, I mean, she should just thank her lucky stars that, you know, we're not doing celebrity birthdays. By the way, Steve Guttenberg is 49 today.
We're not.
Talk show host Craig Kilborn is 45.
Coming up, it's Battle of the Sexes. First, though, we're going to be out at Shotzi's North tonight for Bladderbusters.
But here's the other thing. She just may not like the show. It just may not be for her. And here's the – if we appeal to everybody, then we are bland.
Exactly. Hey, let's move this little bad boy along.
All right. Coming up, we are going to talk about mice experiments. You know, you hear all these stories – we're talking mice birthdays coming up on the show next. No. You hear these experiments with mice and you think, oh, they're going to cure cancer or blindness. And the question is, do they? Do these things actually relate to anything?
And you know what? The big doctors in Washington, D.C., they're going to revamp the guidelines for how much weight a woman should gain during pregnancy. We'll talk to a doctor about it. We'll talk to a brand new mama about it. Coming up on the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Chad Michael Murray, 26 years old.
From NPR News, this is the Bryant Park Project. I'm Allison Stewart, and this fall, an influential medical panel, the Institute of Medicine, a private organization that advises the federal government, will review and consider changes to the medical guidelines for how much weight a woman should gain during pregnancy. The panel hasn't made any changes since 1990. So if you're wondering what those guidelines are, it's about 25 to 35 pounds for normal weight women before they get pregnant, 15 pounds for women who are considered obese, and up to 40 pounds for underweight women. Now, the weird thing is, over time, apparently, women have been gaining more and more weight as they get pregnant. According to the panel, one in five women gained over 40 pounds back in 1990. In 2003, it was one in four women gained over 40 pounds. Whoa. I know, it's a lot of weight. Dr. Tracy Gaudette, is the director of the Center for Integrative Medicine at Duke University, and she writes a column called Consciously Female for Body and Soul magazine. Dr. Gaudette, thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
What do you think has changed now that the guidelines are going to be reviewed?
Well, I actually think it's a good idea that the guidelines are being reviewed. I think that the changes that we're seeing in how much weight women are putting on in pregnancy, from my perspective, is really just a symptom of our whole culture weight gain issue. You know, I don't think it's isolated to pregnancy. I think the same dynamics that are increasing the weight gains and the obesity problems across America are just happening also in pregnancy, and that's not actually surprising.
Now, tell us why gaining too much weight in pregnancy causes problems.
Well, it's interesting because, as you know, I'm an obstetrician and gynecologist, and certainly a tremendous amount of weight gain in pregnancy can be a big issue. When we're talking about the difference between 5 or 10 pounds, the real risk is actually, what does that mean as you continue your life? Because most women, the more weight you gain in pregnancy, naturally, the more likely you are to retain more weight as you go along. And if you gain 5 or 10 or 15 pounds every pregnancy and you have a couple of pregnancies, you can imagine how that contributes to your overall health issues.
Yeah, I'm not very good at math, but I can put that one together.
Exactly. So for obstetrically, just from kind of the pregnancy perspective, yes, you want to have a healthy weight gain. And if you have an extremely excessive weight gain, it can be problematic because the baby can get too large and it can be problematic in other ways for the pregnancy. But really, the reason that the Institute of Medicine is looking at this issue is more for the woman's health, that what is happening as we gain more and more weight across time and across each pregnancy, which is really a symptom of our larger culture where we're just not tuning, we're becoming more and more unconscious about our relationship with food and unconscious with our relationship around weight gain.
Yeah, there was a doctor that was interviewed about this, and he said the reality is that for far too long we are telling pregnant women to take it easy during pregnancy, be confined, and to eat for two. Really, how much more should a woman eat when she's pregnant? How many more calories a day?
It's really interesting because really in the second trimester, the amount of calories additional that you need to your base diet is 350 calories, it's estimated, per day in the second trimester and 500 calories extra in the third trimester, which is not much. I mean, it's an extra cup of milk, it's an extra cup of yogurt, it's an extra piece of fruit, not all of these things, like one of these things.
Right.
You know, and it's easy, it's very easy. It really comes back to like awareness and education and consciousness that many women feel like, yes, I'm pregnant, now I can finally eat anything and everything I want and not feel guilty and not be looked at askance. And the truth of the matter is that awareness of it really isn't a lot of extra calories, and the babies are actually great at taking what they need. If you didn't gain, it's hard to not gain enough to gain too little, because the babies are actually designed when they're in the uterus to take what they need. So this kind of free reign feeling does result in a lot of women putting on a tremendous amount of weight that then is very difficult for them to get off after the pregnancy.
Dr. Tracy Gaudette, thank you so much for helping us out and walking us through the medical part of the story.
Sure thing.
Okay, so for the real part of this story, Luke, we're going to talk to Christina Geis, who just went through this. Apparently, she's just recently finished giving baby Lucy Joy a bath. Did Lucy enjoy it, Christina?
She did. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
She's sleeping, thankfully.
Oh, I know that all new mothers like to hear that. Hey, so what did your doctor advise you about weight gain during your pregnancy?
Well, my doctor said at one of my earliest appointments that anything more than 25 pounds was mine to keep after Lucy was born. And that was pretty good advice for me to follow, I think, throughout the pregnancy. It gave me some kind of barometer.
And were you conscious of it when you were pregnant? Did you think, okay, I can only eat these many calories? Or, and I mean, I'm sure you weren't dieting. I know you well. I know you didn't do that, and you care about the health of your baby. But was it in the back of your mind at all?
I'm not much of a calorie counter to begin with. I'm sort of an everything in moderation kind of girl. So mm-hmm. I sort of followed the same practice while I was pregnant. I did have a book that was a week-by-week guide to pregnancy. And each week it would say, around now you've probably gained, you know, X number of pounds. But again, I think because women vary so much, that range was usually so broad that it didn't really give me much of a gut check. So I really just kind of followed how I felt.
Was this something that you pregnant ladies in prenatal class discuss, the weight gain issue?
Not so much, surprisingly. I think, you know, sometimes too much girl talk can be a bad thing. And I always kind of dance around the subject with girlfriends. You don't really ask women how much they weigh, and I found it to be true in pregnancy as well, which I think maybe was surprising because you assume that sort of all information's out on the table and you're sharing everything, but I found that that was one topic that I didn't discuss as much with other pregnant people.
Did you witness that instance that a doctor talked about of women just saying, okay, all bets off, pass the ho-hos, I have a 9-month pass?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like, everyone has their own version or their own vice of what that ho-ho is, you know? So I think there are definitely people out there who...
What was your version of that?
I went through a fettuccine Alfredo phase, which I like to chalk up to my mother being Italian, and, you know, I was just preparing Lucy for her cooking. But, you know, in general, I kind of followed the whatever I felt like eating. Maybe that meant that that's what my body needed at the time. Now, with fettuccine Alfredo, I don't know how to justify that as well. But, you know, a hamburger probably meant I was hungry for protein. There were other women, though, that I know and some of my peers that really did see it as a green light to, you know, stop over at McDonald's or drive through McDonald's whenever they felt like it. And I think that's because they've probably been depriving themselves of fast food, you know, their entire adult life.
Christina Geist, Lucy Joy's doing great?
She's doing great. She's sleeping well.
Thanks so much for joining us at NPR News.
Thank you. Take care.
Well, speaking of medical studies and things like that, you know, scientists at Duke University say that they have accidentally figured out how to give mice obsessive compulsive disorder. They accidentally deleted, well, maybe they purposefully deleted this gene. It's called SAPAP3. But they didn't know it was going to do what it did. It essentially created OCD in mice, and now they think maybe they can use that information to treat OCD in humans someday. But that's only kind of a maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw this story and we were talking about this medical stuff that was going to be on today, I started thinking, like, every day there's a different – it seems like every day a different study that comes out that says they found that, you know, mice that do this are more likely to do this and that could cure cancer.
Mice that drink caffeine, right, are able to do math better.
Right.
I don't know if mice can do math better, but you know what
right.
I mean.
Exactly. Well, they still – long division is always hard no matter how much Red Bull they have. So I guess I was just kind of wondering how many of these studies that we read about that come out all the time actually end up somewhere, actually lead to some pill or medicine that you or I could take. Somebody who knows a lot more about that than I do is Joe Palca, science correspondent at NPR, extraordinaire. He's even done a series of stories where he sort of followed up on these kinds of studies that he would report, and then years and years later he checked in to see where they sort of went. And Joe Palca joins us now. Hi, Joe.
Howdy.
So all of these studies that we hear about oftentimes with mice, I mean, do many of them pan out?
Pan out. Well,
you sound like
I sound like,
you sound like
sit
a
down,
myth.
Son.
I
mean, I've got a long time to talk.
Like, it sounds like you want to saute the mice or something like that. I think the problem is, you know, you said seems like there's every week. Well, that's the only the ones you're hearing about in the media. I mean, there are thousands of these every day. The journals are bursting with studies that involve something that, you know, some gene that does something to a mouse or some treatment that does something to a rat or something like that. I think it's more an observational issue. You know, we hear about them and you think, oh, this must be important because it's in the news, right? Mm-hmm. But in fact, very few. There's very few lead specifically. You know, one study in a mouse, 10 years later, drug for a person, bang, we've got it. It just very, very, very rarely happens that way. what you get is a tapestry, really, a bunch of studies all taken together to make advance in science, and so that maybe 10 years from now there is a drug, but you would probably point to 10 studies that all sort of focused in on it. It's really the media's reporting, I think, that tend to overemphasize each one of these studies because, you know, obviously we wouldn't talk about these studies if they weren't very important, and so they wouldn't come onto the national media. But in fact, you know, people always say to me, okay, what's the best, the most important science story of 1990 or 2007 or whatever? And I say, ask me in 10 years and I'll tell you.
You know what
it
I have
that long.
Written my last question.
Yep.
What's the biggest science story of 2007?
Right,
I'm just
exactly.
going to take that off the list.
No, scratch that off because, I mean, it just shows the disconnect, I think, between traditional media, you know, what journalists are taught to do. This is something that affects your life that you need to know about today, and the process of science. Because, in fact, there's a gazillion interesting science stories. I mean, just why would one gene cause a mouse to behave like someone with obsessive compulsive disorder? What is that about? That's totally fascinating. Will it lead to anything? Who knows?
Is it annoying or frustrating to cover science because of that? Because people like me that aren't very scientifically oriented, I want to see this sort of, you know, the story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it sounds like you're saying it doesn't really play out that way. Is it hard because you feel like you have to report these stories where you say you talk about this OCD gene, even though you know that it's not going to really unfold the way I want it to, as a listener, to unfold?
Right. I mean, I'd say it's not annoying. It's attention. You know, I came out of a research background. You know, I was going to be a scientist, and I'm not even going to tell you what I was going to cure the world from because that's too long ago. But the fact is, there's this tension. You know, it's a completely different world, and the scientific world never overpromises. It's the last sentence in a grant that says, "And this may someday lead to a treatment." That sentence is pro forma, and it appears at the end of the grant to sort of say, "Here's why we're doing this." But it's like in media, that's the first sentence. That's the first thing you tell people. It could lead to a cure for it. And everybody says, well, where's the cure? Well, I think that's an interesting issue, but it's harder. It's hard to – what I've been trying to do is sort of say let's take a breath here and say all this stuff is going to lead somewhere and it's all interesting, but it's not going to change the world tomorrow.
I think the only solution, Joe, is we're going to put your desk extension phone number on the website, and just when people have questions, they can just call you.
Yeah, that's the easiest way.
And you can kind of just sort of
– no problem.
The good news is we only have 10 listeners to the show, so it won't really be that
well,
many
nine
calls.
after that last segment.
NPR science correspondent Joe Palca, thank you very much for talking to us.
You're welcome.
This is NPR.
Here on the Bryant Park Project, we're always kind of keeping tabs on what's going on the internet. And like a lot of people, I love to check out the most viewed section or the most blogged or the most emailed section. Because I think it's really interesting when that many people become that interested in one story.
Yeah, I think there's another reason why you like to know about the most, capital T, capital M. Because you had a TV show on MSNBC called The Most, it's trademarked and it belongs to Allison Stewart. But it is actually a really good question to kind of see, you know, what the various people are into around the world. And
around our studio. I see three producers.
Exactly. And we've brought them in here to talk to us about some of the most viewed and most emailed stories. Some of them excited to be here. Others, Lauren, less excited.
Lois Bow not having it, but...
But she's going to do
sport.
It. She's taking one for the team. Okay, so first we've got Dan Pashman. Dan, what's your most story?
Well, this is most emailed on Yahoo News and on the New York Times website as well. Scientists have apparently managed to recreate an out-of-body experience using virtual reality goggles that will basically allow you to feel as if you are outside of your own body and looking at yourself from afar. Mm. And it's apparently
without drugs.
Exactly. You're right. It's funny. That's in all the headlines. It's like scientists recreate out of body experience. Parentheses. No drugs.
Wow. That, I don't think I'm ready for that. By the way, like I think the world would fold in on itself for me if I was able to look at myself from outside my body.
All right, Dan. You have to go figure out how to wrap up the show.
All right.
Next up.
Hi.
Lauren, don't make me talk on the radio. Spore.
I'm dealing. I've got two stories. The first one's the LA Times most emailed story. It's a really sad story about elderly Holocaust survivors in Los Angeles. And as they get older, their minds are sort of deteriorating. Some have dementia. and they're seeing Nazis, and this is really terrifying for them. There was one, it's a great piece, the reporter's name is Maria Laganga, I think, and she has one detail in there where this elderly woman's daughter gave her two blankets, and this was terrifying for the woman because she kept hearing voices that said, you have to share those nice blankets, you can't have those nice blankets. Really moving piece.
And the idea was also that they had built up resistance
as 50
young people.
Years.
To be able to survive it all, and as the dementia, the resistance fell away.
Right. So now, when they think of their memories, it's only the most traumatic things running through their heads all day. It's a really sad story. And I've got another one for you. This is a most emailed story from NPR.org. It's a piece by reporter John Nielsen about the return of the bed bugs.
Ew.
Something particularly terrifying to me.
yeah, you've been doing battle with some bed bugs in Brooklyn, right?
The thing is, I don't even have them. I'm just afraid of getting them. active, proactive. So if you don't know, these are bugs that come in, get all over you at night and suck your blood and then leave. So let's hear a clip of John Nielsen's piece.
In the 1950s, exterminators armed with pesticides like DDT drove these parasites out of most of the houses in the country. Then, 10 years ago, the bugs started coming back.
I knew they were like feasting from that mattress. I was getting rid of that mattress. I didn't care what it cost. Yeah.
Feasting?
That's why there are credit cards.
Oh, grody. So what are you doing, Lauren, in Brooklyn to try to manage this situation?
Well, I'm all over a website called bedbugregistry.com. I suggest you check it out and type in your address and see if any apartment in your building has bedbugs, you probably have them too.
Okay, I'm doing that.
Yeah, you
right
should check it
now.
Out right now. And then if you think someone in your building has them, I recommend going to Target and getting these Ziploc vinyl bags and putting your mattress and box spring in these bags, because if they can't live in your mattress, they can't get you.
Bedbugregistry.com.
But then you have to sleep on a piece of plastic like you're a 9-year-old who wets the bed,
it's
right?
It's worth it.
Lauren, I love it. You're the one that didn't want to come on.
I know.
I know.
And you're like, hey, go to this website. Cue the tape. Rock it.
That was a much better toss to tape than Allison and I ever do. And this is supposedly our job. All right, MJ Davis has got the final round of the most.
Yeah, I'll wrap it up for you. There's another story from NPR.org that we're going to talk about today. It's a commentary called Even Mother Teresa Got the Blues, because as it turns out, based on her diary entries, Mother Teresa struggled a lot more than you might think with God, and was there God, and did she feel God every day?
Wow.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because they're fast-tracking her to canonization now.
Mm-hmm.
And so she just died in, 1997, and they're trying to canonize her in the midst of all these republications of her journal entries about her religious doubts. And we actually have a piece of the commentary by Father James Martin if you want to listen to it now.
Sure, let's go for it.
She never really doubted God's existence in these decades. She just couldn't feel it. The idea of dryness, darkness, and even doubt in prayer is not particularly well known, but all the great Christian spiritual masters have dealt with it. St. Ignatius Loyola, the founder of the Jesuit order, wrote in his book The Spiritual Exercises about what he called desolation, and he describes it well. One is listless, tepid, unhappy, and feels separated from our Creator.
Wow. You gotta give it up, though, to Mother Teresa. If she was having doubts, it didn't dampen her spirits for, you know, living in Calcutta and, doing a lot more than a lot of people who, probably never have a doubt.
It's hard to make her the poster child for canonization right now, though.
She's the Cal Ripken Jr. of saints. She's going right to the Hall of Fame.
I can't get this bedbug registry to work,
by the way. Me either. I'm sorry. I'm embarrassed. Am I going someplace where it's warm? Because you're talking about Mother Teresa, and I'm like, bedbug registry can't come. I can't get into the website fast
this
enough.
This is awful.
Will you enter my zip code while you're on there?
Okay.
You know what? I don't know. I wonder what's worse. There's also websites where you can put in your zip code and find out how many sex offenders are in your neighborhood. Mm. Or bedbugs. Which one would you rather have? Sex offending bedbugs would be just the absolute worst.
They do offend you in your bed.
We've gone down a long, dark road.
Oh, this is why we're supposed to have a script. That's why. Okay. This has been the Bryant Park Project. MJ Davis, Lauren Sporer, Dan Pashman, Wynn Rosenfeld somewhere, Manya Zupa, peering over the shoulder of Manoli Weatherall. Of course, Matt Martinez in his corner.
I'm Allison Stewart in my corner.
I'm Luke Burbank. Have a great weekend.
Actor Rupert Grint is 19, and I already mentioned Steve Guttenberg. Sorry about that. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I had to do it.